children. Hi, and welcome to Cartwheels on the Sky, Poets, Poems, and Discovery. I'm your host, Blake Moore, and for the next 30 minutes, you're going to get a glimpse into the poems and process of San Francisco poet, professor, and beat legend Dan Langton. Before we start our conversation, I want to tell you a bit about him. He was a longtime creative writing professor at San Francisco State University. He arrived in San Francisco during the burgeoning beat movement, and he held a poetry gathering, he hates the word salon, in San Francisco in the Haight-Ashbury that was legendary. And to this day, he is loved by so many poets and renowned as an important mentor for a new generation of poets. Daniel Langton has won national and international prizes in England, Ireland, and the United States, including the coveted Devins Award for Poetry in 1967. He has a PhD from UC Berkeley, and he has taught in the University Creative Writing and English departments at SF State University for 50 years. He will be 94 in September, which is this month, and by all accounts, he is right now turning out some of the best work of his life. In his words, "I am an old man in a hurry." It's an honor and a pleasure to bring Daniel's voice to Mendonoma. And if you've never heard of him, you are in for a treat for sure. I hope you enjoy this conversation he and I had earlier this week.
Dan Langton, it's really a pleasure to have you with me here on Cartwheels on the Sky, and I would love for you to start us off with one of your poems.
All right. It's called "The Price of Life." I understand salmon. I too have stared ahead, surrounded by others like me, as the goal narrowed, as the chum on the thin lines wiggled near me and for me, the barriers as big as churches. And now this river, different birds, but the same song. I understand salmon, why they are seething as the water enters their heads.
Ah, wow. Is that a recent poem?
No, it's Mark's favorite.
So I want to get to talking a little bit about your background. And I know you were discovered by William Carlos Williams. I would love for you to talk about how you met him and your relationship and the long correspondence and how your relationship with him impacted your life and your existence as a poet.
Well, he wrote novels, and he thought of himself as a novelist. He told me once he thought he was primarily a novelist till he was 54. And I read his novels, and he gave a reading here in town. And, of course, he gave a reading of his poetry, and I was stunned. He invited audience to come backstage afterwards, and I went in, and he said amazing things. And I walked out really, really stunned. I went home, and I wrote a poem. My first poem, and I sent it to him, and I got a letter back. I couldn't believe the letter. I can quote it to you in its entirety. He said, "I don't know what you're doing, but stop doing it and only write poetry." And that began our correspondence. And
do you remember what that poem was?
Oh, sure. I've forgotten the title by now, but it was a poem about him, obviously. A national magazine took it. It had taken me 15 minutes to write it, and they sent me $10. And I thought to myself, that's $40 an hour. I'm going to get into this record.
Yeah.
and I don't know if I'd have stayed with it, but everything I wrote sold. And I was kind of amazed. And I took his advice. I abandoned my novel and started writing poetry.
And how did that eventually lead you as a position as a professor at SF State, right? You were part of the Pegasus.
I had a very well-paying job, but I was unhappy. And I decided, well, I'm a poet, so I quit my job. My wife quit her job, and Mark and Eve and I went to live in Europe for a couple of years, I guess. And I came back unemployed. So I went to State College, and they recommended me to a high school, and I became a high school teacher. And 4 years later, I resigned because the school board had become insanely right-wing. So I went to the chairman of the Department of English at State, and I said, could you find me a job teaching high school? And she said, I've heard of you. You want to work here? That's the whole story.
Wow. And what year was that?
63.
You taught there for how many years?
I started teaching there on my 40th birthday, and I resigned on my 90th birthday.
And I know you've influenced so many people, and I think you've been in San Francisco for 67 years. And I know from not just your son and Diane, but other people, I've been asking around about you, that you've been such an important pulse in the San Francisco poetry scene. And I know you have a lot of insights and tales about those happy hippie days of the 50s in North Beach, and also
in the 60s
in Haight-Ashbury.
I can sum it up for you, because the only parts I think are valuable are the parts nobody else are talking about. Like, they're talking about the 60s. Well, what the 60s were was finally the public expression of the very private 50s.
Right.
What the poets were in the 50s were the young men. Oh, and it was men. The Chronicle, during the height of it all, the Chronicle did a poll of poets who were living and publishing in San Francisco. 62 men and 2 women.
Wow.
Yeah, it was the young man's game. It really was.
Who were the 2 women that were published?
Oh, Lordy.
Do you remember? That's okay. I just was curious. I'll look that up myself. You don't need to recall that. That's a very curious truth.
Well,
that
they were
I
both.
Don't think
they
I've
were
heard
both part
before.
Of the. I can tell you, they were both part of the problem, because there was a thing in New York, and I worked in New York for a while. It's called Virgins and Whores. Did you ever hear of that?
No.
The only women who could get published were nuns and prostitutes. Well, what the nuns did
yeah.
is write about why they love God, and why the other women wrote poems is because they sold.
Right. That's so true. And it's, you know, the female voice in poetry, I don't think a lot of women that are published today even recognize how far we've come in such a short period of time.
Well, they thought they were part of a revolution of emancipation, not realizing that that was true, but it was for their men or the men they knew, not for them. And it was
right.
a movement of males.
Yeah. Yeah.
And,
the other thing
is about the poets, the men poets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people like Ginsberg are considered wild hippies. Every major poet on the hippie side of the coin went to an Ivy League college. Every last
yeah.
one.
And they were good boys, weren't they? They were good boys when they started, they were not rebels at all.
The one thing you can say, Blake, is that they were good boys in high school, or that they had
mm-hmm.
never gotten to Columbia. Oh, yeah. What they were revolting against was their younger selves.
Uh-huh. Right.
Like putting up with, many were gay, and they had put up with the bad treatment of gays for years. And they turned on that, especially Alan. He really...
Yeah.
Howl is really about that.
Yes, it is. Do you want to read a poem that you have from that time, or is there some kind of poem that talks to that?
I'll read you a poem because I love to read people poems. My wife and I were walking in a forest, and there were thousands of crows, and we were alone, and all of a sudden, perfect silence. So here's the poem about that, okay?
Yes, indeed.
The dense insistence of crows, like conversations on a train in China. The darkened trees looking ready to take fright. The din, as far as that goes, as real on our skin as rain, or the skittish legs of bees out for the first time at night. But then it was still, and all those branches burdened with the strain of silence bobbed like those Chinese on the train in calm delight. Eve, I said, before the moment flew, they all stop to look at you.
Be still my heart. What a beautiful swoon. Oh, thank you.
There's one thing I would like to say. There were the hippie poets who pretended to be uneducated, wild men who really weren't, just maybe outside the law, some of them. And there were the poets who, by and large, were married, settled, middle-class types. But we were extraordinarily friendly, and we met just about every night in North Beach. Or we met at each other's houses and yelled at each other about each other's poems. It was a great time. There's a line in a British poet, to be in London at that time was very heaven. Well, to be at San Francisco at that time was very heaven.
And you were responsible for a very well-known poet salon, correct?
I would never use that word. That people would laugh at me. No. The English have something called at home, and it means that you can come over without being invited. And poets came and read to each other. Also, I did something that would have drawn poets from the moon. I learned how to make beer.
By offering them beer, and you learned how to make beer, so it was truly free.
Well, not only that, it was 5 cents a quart. Really?
Believe you.
and every poet who visited Sam, I'll tell you one anecdote. Robert Lowell came because, you know, he'd come in town and people would say, there were other at-homes, by the way. But he showed up and he had a very good time. But when he was leaving, he said, where's your guest book? I'm going to sign it. And he was enraged when I said, I don't have a guest book. I guess you do things in New England. I remember something somebody said at the party from New England. I said to him, which poet did you like better, best of the evening? And he said, Joe. And I said, there were two Joes. And he said, Mister, you have to, in California, you have to know a poet intimately before you find out his last name. I thought it was funny as hell.
Why in California?
Well, because it's true. Like when I would meet somebody distinguished, I'd introduce somebody distinguished to somebody else, and I would say, and John, this is Breckenridge Long, and the guy would stick out his hand and say, hi, Breck. And back there, you know, the switch from Mr. Langton to Dan could take years.
It's a very different, the East Coast, West Coast kind of familiarity. I understand. So there's a picture that Mark sent me. That's a wonderful picture that you call 14 poets and their accountant. This black and white photo, and you've got your old friends. I think it was taken in 1965 at a Beat reunion. And you're in the center, and you're wearing horn-rim glasses, and there's Ferengetti and his umbrella, and you're between Ginsberg and somebody else in a denim jacket. And my understanding from that photo that your wife is there somewhere, and that same day Bob Dylan hit on her. And I want to hear how she responded. I want you to tell that story.
Oh, well, Bob Dylan was in the pictures. But then his agent or lawyer showed up, and there was some contractual business about his not posing. So they started over. When it ended, we all went. There was a bar, and it was in front of City Lights. And there was a bar next door. They may still be there. I don't know. And so we all went to the bar, and we sat wherever we sat at the tables. Dylan sat down next to Eve, and they chatted amiably. At one point, Eve was very tall. He's not very tall. So at one point, he said to her, what would you do with me if you took me home? And Eve said, I'd give you a bath.
That's a great response.
Well, I tried to get him to come and talk to my class, but I think that killed that.
Yeah, exactly. He's all rebuffed.
A quick reminder, you're listening to Cartwheels on the Sky on KGUA. I'm your host, Blake Moore, and I'm speaking with poet Daniel Langton.
Do you have another poem you want to share?
You want another poem? Yeah, let me find one.
Of course I do.
Okay, this poem is rather complex, but I have a theory about poetry. You know, the guy who taught me was Robert Frost. He wrote a poem about Dante's Commedia, only the poem is about baseball. In uh-huh. other words, you can delight all kinds of audiences. So this poem is about how poets turn real things into metaphor, but they're nothing compared to real things. You ready?
Yes, indeed.
It's called October 8th. I noticed the leaves today. I have been sick and losing touch, but there they surely were, falling from crowded trees, playing at survival, trying to make my brain as thick as those gatherings, those wrinkled ends. There may. Lying like truthful books, the winners burn, told in a language I will never learn. My brother has been dead a year today. I think of all the poems that use the fall to euphemize a death, but Jimmy died this blazing time of year, and all the kinds of metaphor won't reach the boy I call and hunger for, the boy I slept beside. They are just leaves. Life teaches. Art reminds.
Yes, indeed. I love that. It's kind of interesting because one of the questions I wanted to ask you about how so much of the history and poetry has gone from this cultural expression to this kind of rarefied, taking itself very seriously art form.
That's a whole can of worms. Well, briefly what's happened. The first English department in the world opened in 1890 because colleges said, why would we have an English department? They all speak English. And now, of course, you have to have an MA before you can read a poem. What has happened is that poetry was mostly, for most people, it was songs they learned, popular poetry. But also, you know, if you're told something's difficult, it becomes difficult. Let me give you a story. In California, in the gold rush, these miners had nothing to do at night and plenty of gold. So theater companies came out here and did Shakespeare, and these illiterate miners sat there and sobbed at what happened to poor Juliet, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now you're supposed to take a course in Shakespeare. He's not that hard. He's in English. He really is.
Right.
And my example was Lisbon. There are practically no new movies in Portuguese. There are some made in Brazil, but none in Portugal. And movies come in from foreign countries in foreign languages. And the, people put on tuxedos and gowns and go to a ball and then go to the movie, and it's high culture. On the other hand, when my son was living in Italy, he went to the children's opera with his other friends, and they ate sandwiches and watched the opera. Because the opera in Italy is not art, it's culture. And the movies in Portugal are not culture, they're art. And what happened in the 20th century, usually from highly trained men, Ezra Pound's first book, I have it, is signed by Ezra Pound, M.A., that tells you more than you want to.
That says a lot.
That tells you, yeah. And you're supposed to be trained, and you're a hell of a lot of poets didn't know how to read and write, let alone anything else. And I think the 20th century move, headed by Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot, and the one the hippies were revolting against, were an attempt to turn our culture into an art.
And it keeps happening today. It's very interesting as someone who has always thought of myself as an outsider poet. And when I showed up in North Beach in the 80s, You know, I lived on Grant Street right above the old Schlock Shop and dressed in all black and started reading at poetry readings. And I was fortunate enough to encounter a few of the remaining old timers who were students of old timers. And I just caught that next wave.
Oh, Grant Avenue was where all the hippie bars were and all the beat bars were.
It was amazing, and I really identified with the outsider poetry movement. I'm an economics major. I did not study poetry. I wasn't incredibly well-read, but I loved listening to my friends read what they've written. That's what gave me my most influential poet to that point was the poet Rumi. That's what made me want to start writing poems. And I'm not even sure if Rumi even wrote. He just spoke. So there was this living language that I felt was happening even then in North Beach.
Please send me some of your poems.
I will. I will send you some poems. Maybe you'll tell me to keep writing like William Carlos Williams did to you. It would be an honor. I'll definitely send you some poems. And I'm curious because we're running out of time, and I do want to find out what you're doing now. Mark tells me you've been doing a lot of writing, and so how poetry expresses itself, and if you're working on a new book, and if you'd end today with a new poem.
I finished a poem about 15 minutes before I called you. Well, I retired, of course, just in time for the pandemic. And for the first time in my life, I was alone and I couldn't go anywhere because Mark was worried about me. And I found that I was more interested in rereading than in reading. And then gradually, I took to writing poems, which I had laid aside when things weren't going well. And it became like a high fever, you know, four poems a day kind of thing. And most of which you throw away, sure, but still. T.S. Eliot wrote poems for 55 years, and when he died, he had published 55 poems.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, my God. I can do that on a three-day weekend.
I know. When I first started writing, I made sure I wrote at least a poem a day. That was my practice, every day a poem. And now I would say that if you count email, I write a poem a day because I do try with certain people that all of our correspondences are poetic. So I don't keep a journal as rigorously as I used to, but I still journal. But I do a lot of my writing now on a computer, which is very cold, but I appreciate the ease of it.
Well, I have to use a typewriter because my handwriting has gone to hell. By the way, I want to tell you something. Allen Ginsberg started by writing a poem a day. William Carlos Williams started by writing a poem a day. You're in good company.
And I'm talking to you, Dan, so I'm in great company. Thank you. That just tickles me.
Living alone, which I had never done in my life. I came from a large family to college, to the army, to marriage. I had never lived alone. And I found that the secret to not going crazy is to, well, a poet once said, when the muse goes by your desk, make sure you're there.
And sometimes I know the muse goes by my desk and I'm so far in the other room, and then I try to remember what the muse told me. So I do try to keep a pen and paper around me all the time so I can catch
a pen and paper right next to your pillow at night?
Of course.
Oh, yeah. I tried not doing that, and I've lost great poems. I woke up in the morning, and I said to myself, I know there was two great lines, but what were they?
Yes, exactly. I had one of the first ones like that came to me was, words don't have to be spoken to be heard. And I woke up in the morning and read that in my journal. I said, did I write that? You know, I didn't even remember putting that down, but it was such a profound aha moment. And I ultimately painted that on, I was driving a 1969 Car Magia at the time, and I painted that on my Car Magia.
I have a quote for you applies to you, of course. Again, from William Carlos Williams in a letter. He said, when I was first, because he knew I wrote my first poem at 28, and he knew I was in new waters, so he wrote to me about making friendships. And he said, poets are just like everybody else, except when they're good people, and then they will be the best people you ever meet.
Mm. Wow.
That's how it turned out.
What a beautiful thing to say. That's so true in my life. Some of my best friends are, I have so much respect and awe for the words that they bring through their pen.
Oh, especially when people don't like us. You know, somebody once said to me, being a poet is like volunteering to be poor. Oh, I make $1,000 a year at least.
At least.
Which, by the way, was pretty much what Frost made. You make your money teaching and reading.
That's true.
Yeah, you sell a poem to a very rich magazine and they send you a free subscription. That happens.
And then yes, it does.
I know a way you can cheer up people and impress them.
Yes.
I do it all the time. Well, you give them a poem or maybe a magazine with you in it, but let's say you give them a poem and you say, now, I know this isn't much, but hang on to it. And 10 generations from now, it'll be worth millions. You know, I just figured out why we didn't meet each other on Grand Avenue. We must be two generations apart.
We are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I still would have asked you to dance.
Oh, thank you. And I would have loved to share poetry, and I promise I'll send you some poems. And would you do me a favor and read one more poem for us to end the show?
Now?
Yeah.
Yes, okay.
Okay.
It's called Three Great Things. I've never done this in my life before. It's got ink marks all over it.
World debut. Uh-huh.
Somebody once said to me, what are the three great things in life? And I've been wanting to write this poem ever since. Three great things. Walking to the movies, the pictures, walking home from the movies at night. I know I have always liked to read because I made the images move, but there were often other strictures, the problems that were kept out of sight, real skills you had to have to succeed, or if you had them, you must improve. With movies, all you do is look, and there will be others like you, laughing and flinching at the same scenes, when they crash a car or catch a crook. Sometimes you get to leave two by two, just as you were learning what life means. That's a sonnet.
Your language is so beautiful, and there's a romance to your words that's not sticky sweet. It's just a beauty.
Well, you know, my father was an Irish immigrant, and they say in Ireland that notes to the milkman are poems. It's probably true.
Oh, Dan, what an honor to get this time with you. You are such a beautiful human being. And
okay, till we meet again.
Till we meet again. Thank you so much.
Well, there you have it. Poet and legend Daniel Langton. Here on KGUA Wallala, Cartwheels on the Sky, I'm your host, Blake Moore. Thanks so much for spending some time with me this Saturday night, and keep on enjoying that Saturday night. Stay tuned for more great programming on words and writing. And otherwise, yeah, have a wonderful month. I'll be back in your ear next month, first Saturday. Thanks, KGUA, for being here. Thanks, y'all, for supporting us. Have a great evening.